Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hello, New York. You're listening to Revolutions for a Minute, live from the new WBAI studios, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by over 9,000 plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. I'm Chris Carr, he, him pronouns, joining from the Upper West Side and a member of the RPM Collective, but I'm not alone here in the studio.
Hey, what's up, New York City? This is Amy Wilson, she, her. I'm an abortion rights organizer and a host and producer of Revolutions Per Minute.
Earlier this month, voters in the state of Kansas roundly rejected the so-called Value Them Both measure, a proposed constitutional amendment that would have laid the groundwork for a complete abortion ban in the future. This measure, pushed by extremist anti-abortion lobbies, was defeated in a 59-41% result by the voters of Kansas. Tonight, we're speaking to Melinda, an organizer with Lawrence DSA and chair of the Political Action Committee Vote No Kansas, and Dr. Russell Fox, professor of political science at Friends University in Wichita, on the organizing that successfully defeated this ballot measure. We will also hear from Alyssa, an organizer with Reproductive Justice Collective here at NYC, on the right-wing rise in the courts and the impact of groups like the Federalist Society. We'll be taking your calls later in the show, so keep a hand on that dial. But first, the headlines and a special elections update with Lee Zishi.
I'm Lee Zishi, and these are the headlines for Wednesday, August 24th, 2022. In local news, a coalition of progressive groups sent a letter to Governor Hochul insisting that her nomination to replace Court of Appeals Chief Judge DeFiore not be a former prosecutor. Cuts at the Department of Education may jeopardize restorative justice programs that seek to deal with disciplinary issues without resorting to suspensions or arrest. A Broome County judge struck down the county jail's ban on in-person visitations, which had remained in effect since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Drought-like conditions have hit the tri-state area. And Trader Joe's shut down their only wine store in New York right before workers were planning to unionize. In election news, the commission tasked with redrawing the city's council districts for next year's elections is taking public input through the end of August. Provisional districts unveiled last month showed the creation of the city's first district that would be majority Asian American, but such a district is generating criticism from some in the Asian American community who fear it could disrupt existing political coalitions. And yesterday was primary day for state Senate and congressional races. This was the second primary held this summer in New York following a redistricting debacle. All three candidates running to succeed Alessandra Biaggi in the Bronx 34 Senate District oppose the construction of an affordable housing project on vacant land that would provide housing to critically ill former Rikers detainees. Assemblywoman Natalia Fernandez won that race last night. And Biaggi lost her bid against the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Sean Patrick Maloney, for Congressional District 17. In the newly drawn 10th Congressional District, millionaire Daniel Goldman narrowly beat Assemblymember Yuli Nu in a very crowded field after spending millions of his own money. Nu has not ruled out running in the general election on the Working Family Party line. Before yesterday's primary, Mayor Adams endorsed Conrad Tillard, a reverend with significant real estate backing, in his attempt to unseat DSA-endorsed State Senator Jabari Brisport. Adams defended Tillard after revelations of anti-Semitic, homophobic, and anti-abortion statements in the reverend's past were brought to light. Mayor Adams also endorsed State Senator Kevin Parker and Elizabeth Crowley, meaning he endorsed against nearly every DSA-endorsed candidate in 2022. Parker's win over DSA-endorsed candidate David Alexis to represent District 21 in Flatbush, Brooklyn, was one of the mayor's few victories last night. Despite being heavily outspent, Alexis, a rideshare driver, organizer, and father, gave the longtime incumbent a run for his money, with Parker getting less than 50% of the total vote. However, it was mostly a bad night politically for the mayor, and most of his endorsements lost. Brisport soundly defeated Tillard, receiving over 70% of the vote, and DSA endorsed candidate for the newly formed District 59, representing parts of Queens, Brooklyn, and Manhattan, trounced Elizabeth Crowley. In Brooklyn, Gonzalez beat Crowley 4-1, and in Queens, 2-1. Here's Gonzalez at her victory party last night.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming today and for all of the hours and hours of work you have all put into getting us here today. This is a significant moment in our movement, because with our 750 volunteers, our over 3,000 individual donors, and our countless volunteer hours, we proved that $1 million cannot buy a movement. We proved that people power can beat political dynasties, that we as a collective movement ain't going nowhere, that we're here to stay. And that we'll keep our winning. For the first time in the city, we're gonna have a socialists represent a part of Manhattan. Yeah. For the second time in history, we beat a Crowley. And for the first time in this country, we are going to have a socialist at every level of government. Moment, because we have a lot of work ahead of us. But the truth is, we know we can win. We make New York, not the corporations, not the lobbyists, not those dynasties. And we know that we will win our better future. And it starts right here.
That was Kristen Gonzalez in Long Island City last night after her impressive victory over real estate and Republican-backed Elizabeth Crowley. We'll share more from her victory party on next week's show, so be sure to tune in. I'm Lee Zishi, and now back to the studio.
Thank you, Lee. Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by New York City DSA's Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. You can subscribe at thethornnyc.substack.com. We want to extend a congratulations to Kristen Gonzalez for her amazing win, and a congratulations to David Alexis and all the organizers on his campaign for a very, very hard-fought battle. Again, we're going to be covering that more in future shows, so please tune in. Now let's turn to our live guests for tonight. We have some wonderful organizers here in the studio to help us discuss the issue of abortion rights. But first, let's get to know a little bit about each of you, and we'll ask you the question that we love to ask our guests here on Revolutions Per Minute. How did you get into movement organizing, and what social forces have shaped your life and your politics? Alyssa, let's hear from you first.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to everybody today. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a third year law student at Columbia, focusing on gender justice. particularly on reproductive rights as well as queer rights. And I also serve as the co-facilitator of the Reproductive Justice Collective at Columbia. I've had an interest in gender justice from a young age. I grew up in a fundamentalist sect of Christianity, so I was faced with gross discrimination, inequality, and even blatant hatred of women from a very young age. I was fortunate to break away from that and attend college, where I learned about the work of groups like ACT UP and Las Madres, and I knew that I wanted to combine the power of the legal system with activism to help transform the rights of people, particularly youth, who find themselves in oppressive and hyper-religious environments. Since then, I've spent some time at the National Organization for Women, and I will be working at the ERA project at Columbia this fall. But right now, most of my organizing efforts pertain to helping lead the Reproductive Justice Collective at Columbia to do education, lobbying, fundraising, and direct action around abortion access.
Hi, my name is Melinda LaVon, and I am from Lawrence, DSA, in Kansas. I grew up rural Leavenworth County in Kansas. That's in the northeast part of the state. Farming. I would say that my dad is probably a strong political influence on all of us. He was to the left a bit as a Democrat in general. Growing up, we always watched things like PBS NewsHour and tried to always learn really accurate information as opposed to just more of the right-wing literature kind of stuff and church culture that we were surrounded in at the time. For the last 25 years, I've made my home in Lawrence, Kansas, home of the Jayhawks. I started as an activist doing things like handing out condoms at the Douglas County AIDS Project events, knocking on doors for Democrats and things like that. I've run a school bond campaign here and a few other things. In 2020, some things changed. Folks needed marshalling support from our DSA chapter. I got really involved with that and started getting involved in DSA leadership. And then our chapter ran three campaigns that year, three in 2021. We started organizing around this amendment in 21. And I'll tell you a little more about me too. I am a home birth midwife, is what I do for money. And so some of the laws that could have changed had Kansas not stopped this abortion amendment, I could have easily gotten charged with multiple felonies every day for just doing my job. So it was very personal to me to fight this amendment.
Hello, everyone. I'm really appreciative of the opportunity to come and speak with a bunch of activists and organizers that have done such impressive work. I am an academic, and so while I am involved in organizing, I'm actually more of an observer of organizing than someone who does a lot of it myself. I teach politics and history at Friends University. I'm not a native of Kansas. I'm originally from Washington State. I grew up there in a large Mormon family. Still practice that faith. And so when you ask questions about my involvement in socialism and my political sympathies and my involvement in favor of reproductive justice, I have to talk about my evolution along two different tracks. Because even as my politics turned left and I became much more engaged in issues of economic justice and racial justice and concerns about equality that in a lot of ways were a challenge to the conservative environment I was brought up in, I mostly did not change my mind when it came to a lot of issues having to do with gender, particularly in regards to abortion. My mind there was changed not primarily by my political work or my academic studies. It was primarily changed by the fact that my wife and I have been married for 29 years, and we have four daughters, the youngest of which is 16 years old. They're grown. They're out making their own choices. And I came to realize that a lot of the things that I had a rather simplistic, religiously informed view of were not very fair, to the kinds of choices that these people that I love as young women were having to confront, decisions they were having to make, decisions about love and sex and their professional lives. And I just came to appreciate how enormous the task of thinking through all of these sometimes burdensome issues can be. And I realized that I was now no longer comfortable with, indeed, I was kind of repulsed by the idea that any group of people, that any party or government agency could come into the lives of my daughters or into the life of my wife and tell them, no, this choice should not be available to you. That's wrong. And so I became a belated convert to the cause of reproductive justice. And I hope I can repent of having been a little bit slow for coming along for all that. I'm glad to be here and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, thank you, Russell, Melinda, and Alyssa. We're very excited to have you on the show tonight to hear your voices together. And we thank you for sharing so frankly and personally about the different factors that brought you into this particular struggle. Melinda, have to appreciate your shout out to protest marshals. I'm a protest marshal here in New York City myself, and it's a role I'm thrilled to play, a very important one. And yeah, shout out to all the people who take that on. For those who are just tuning in, you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we are talking about socialists' role in the successful campaign to defeat an anti-abortion ballot measure in Kansas and the right-wing influence on our court system that led to the repeal of Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, for also giving shout-outs, as a fellow academic, I appreciate Russell being here. So I just have to say. So, but like getting to this like larger conversation about like what really led to where we are now with the court. Like the Dobbs decision was the result of many decades of organizing by the anti-abortion lobby in coalition with the right and the far right. And this has really brought like a lot more attention about like what led us to this place and like what were the major players in the game like on the right that really led to this. And so I wanted to throw this question to Alyssa and then to Russell afterwards. But what has led us to this moment of right-wing power in the courts, and what is the role of groups like the Federal Society in this rightward drift of the courts?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can't talk about how we've gotten here to this moment without talking about the Federal Society. And just for people who may not have as much of an understanding of what the group is, I'll give a bit of background. The Federalist Society is a right-wing conservative legal organization. They operate in national chapters similar to DSA, but they're also very powerful and present on law school campuses across the country. And the group was founded in direct response to the civil rights victories of the Warren Court and sort of saw its mission as righting those wrongs and bringing America back to where it had been before that point. They boldly profess originalism and require members to adhere to strict conservative values. And they may like to paint themselves as simply a legal ideological group that provides a forum for conservative thought. But in reality, the group operates on a much more powerful level. I think the dark money that they receive is one of the leading ways that they exert this power. And this has actually been in the news this week as the Federalist Society received the largest ever one-time donation to a political cause of a whopping $1.6 billion. And it goes all to a trust. So they sort of evade the campaign finance reporting requirements, and all donations can be done anonymously. So they use these large sums of money that work their way through their organization to support adherence to their values and their tenets in their campaigns for state judgeships, in pressing them for confirmation hearings for federal judgeships, as well as for state and federal legislative roles. So pretty much if you are going for a conservative seat, whether that be in your capacity as a judge or a legislature, you probably won't get that seat unless you have FedSoc's stamp of approval. So they very much control the people who are in positions of power in our country. And since Roe was decided in 1973, the organization pretty much began its plan to pack the judiciary, both state and federal, with individuals, judges, clerks, every member of the court, with people who were hostile to abortion. And this isn't something that they've been shy about either. You can listen to them speak at conventions, at law school events, and they will very publicly declare that Roe was wrongly decided and should be overturned. So I think their role has been a central player in getting us to where we are today. Just for point of reference, all six of the justices who voted to uphold the Mississippi abortion ban in Dobbs were lifelong members of FedSoc, and all five who voted to completely overturn Roe versus Wade are also members of the Federalist Society. So truly, they have engineered this moment. This has been coming. They have put an immense amount of manpower as well as financial power to bring us here. And as Justice Thomas very blatantly said in his concurring opinion, abortion rights is not the place where they will stop. The Federalist Society will continue to bring a war on our civil rights.
Alyssa's summary of the power and the organization of the Federalist Society is pretty excellent. There's not a lot I would want to add to that. The one thing I might want to say is that they worked very hard for a long time trying to figure out what they thought would be the most effective rhetorical and legal positions to take to build momentum towards decisions like the Dobbs decision. And so you have the rhetoric of originalism, talking about the U.S. Constitution as something that is not a democratic institute. It's not an instrument of democratic rule. Instead, it's something that has to contain and constrain the people, even as the people grow and develop and change over time. They particularly use the language of originalism to demonize the idea of a right to privacy. They were able to develop talking points that really kind of mocked the idea that within the Constitution, when it makes guarantees about freedom of speech and protecting your home and your person from unreasonable searches and seizures, that somehow means that there's this right to privacy. And I think that and this might be an interesting way to pivot over to what happened in Kansas. The decision by the Kansas State Supreme Court to defend abortion rights on the basis of something other than privacy, but instead on this idea of bodily integrity and that, you know, people have a right to control their own bodies, that was, I think, in part motivated by an understanding by some people on the Kansas State Supreme Court that the well had been poisoned in a lot of the way by the Federalist Society when it comes to, you know, talking about being left alone, you know, protecting your right of privacy. They thought it was important to find a different legal language because the opponents of abortion have worked so hard and so long to build up a range of ways to denounce previous justifications for abortion rights.
Yeah, here in Kansas, thank you so much for discussing the Federalist Society. A lot of our laws here in Kansas, just like all over, especially the Southeast, come from an adjacent organization, ALEC, the American Legal Exchange Council. They love to write crazy abortion laws and just pass them out to senators and representatives who will present them. This happened in Missouri. They didn't even realize that ectopic pregnancy was included in the bill that they turned in, literally didn't even read it first, just completely trusted ALEC and friends to write that law and put it up. And here in the state of Kansas, you know, 20 years ago, we used to have 26 abortion clinics that were accessible all over the state. We didn't have nearly as many restrictions as we do today. And today, there are only a couple of clinics open in only two cities in Wichita and Kansas City area. there's 19 laws heavily restricting access to abortion. So really what we did this summer to vote no on the amendment kept all those heavy restrictions in place. And it's very unfortunate. The leftist position was not involved whatsoever.
Thank you for all three of you for those comments. And, you know, talking about abortion rights in Kansas, I can't help but think about, you know, the famous Dr. Tiller, who was martyred for this cause, and the organization Trust Women that is located in Kansas, and sort of the legacy as well that we see of violence against abortion providers, as well as clinics and far-right groups like Operation Rescue as well. Is there anything else briefly that you'd like to say about that context, Melinda, before we move on into the rest of our show?
Sure. Dr. Tiller was actually shot twice. He was shot 9 years before he was murdered. He recovered and went back to being a physician to provide abortions until he was murdered. We've had around the nation at least 16 providers murdered and at least 34 escorts murdered over the last couple of decades that I'm aware of. It can be really dangerous work, and advocating for abortion rights for all pregnant people can be dangerous, especially in places that have a lot of guns. We have open carry here, things like that, things you don't have in New York. It's not uncommon to go to a store and see someone open carrying. It's a different environment for sure.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. I feel like there's so much more we could add to this conversation, and I can't wait for us to resume. But to those listening at home, you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI and NYC Broadcasting at 99.5 and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we're talking about organizing for abortion rights as socialists in Kansas and New York City, because the fight for abortion rights is nationwide. We'll be opening the phone lines in about 10 minutes or so, so please join the conversation if you have something to add. I think what has been very clear so far is that, like, the Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court did not come out of nowhere. It was part of a long, concerted effort by the right from the top on down, from front groups like the Federalist Society and their billionaire donors to the anti-abortion factions of the Christo-fascist right. With the right and their wealthy allies on the march, the need for an independent media to uplift the voices of organizers on the front lines of the fight has never been more important. But for us to do that, for us to be able to have the ability to counter the right and their army of propagandists on the radio and on the TV, non-commercial radio stations like WBAI need to pay the rent. We need to keep the lights on and do everything else that we can to keep us broadcasting at 99.5 FM for the fine folks of New York. That's where you, the listener, comes in. So if you're listening at home and you want to hear more from folks like Alyssa, Melinda, and Russell, and are inspired by the work to protect abortion rights in Kansas and in New York, then please don't hesitate to give to the station. It would be greatly appreciated. If you believe in the work we're doing here at WBAI and want to keep shows like Revolutions Per Minute on the air, and you have the ability to donate monthly, then please consider being a BAI buddy. Who doesn't want to be a buddy? It's great. So anything that you can give helps. Even a little bit from everyone listening right now can build into something great. Because in the end, that's what this is all about. The fascists and the corporations that fund them may have the money, but we have the people. So to give to the station, please call 212-209-2950. I'll say it again, 212-209-2950. Or go to WBAI.org and say Chris and Amy sent you. Thank you.
Thank you. So now let's get back to our conversation with our three live guests and discuss how these conditions and the background moved organizers into action and moved into a successful campaign that culminated in a vote earlier this month, where Kansan voters rejected the so-called Value Them Both amendment. So Melinda, you were deeply involved in that. Can you lay out for our listeners who may not have followed this story super closely, what was the amendment and how did you organize against it? And what was successful about your efforts that might be of note to organizers across the country?
Absolutely. So the amendment itself would have given the legislature in the state of Kansas the power to do anything they want regarding abortion regulation, and it would automatically be considered constitutional because we've said it was in our constitution. That was fundamentally what it would have done. Now, they don't even envision a time in the state of Kansas, which we've done before 100 years ago, where we had the majority of our elected leaders were socialist or socialist adjacent. And so today, if we actually elected a much more left legislature and had that amendment passed, we could have said that we will use state funds. We will have abortions in county health departments. We will have abortions available at every emergency room because it would have been automatically constitutional, whatever the legislature says. When our chapter started looking at this, we weren't sure, can we even beat this thing or not? And so the Lawrence DSA chapter started text banking project last summer, where we started text banking the unaffiliated voters. Now, in the state of Kansas, the unaffiliated voter or independent voter is the second largest group of registered voters in the state of Kansas. And they're a bit of a mystery to us. And so we texted unaffiliated voters in basically the eastern third of the state of Kansas, and also Democrats, to get a better idea of who supports abortion access. What our chapter did was text rural Democrats and unaffiliated with the question that asked them, which of the following do you want elected leaders to focus on? Marijuana legalization, we don't have that here. Abortion access, we barely have that here. Housing problems being worked out. We have housing problems just like you do in New York. And the fourth issue was $15 an hour minimum wage. Everybody thinks Kansas is so right-winged. It's really not. We found that between 40 and 58% of the unaffiliated voters in the state of Kansas supported all four of those issues. And that told us that we could win this thing. Sometimes you get into the issue where the political parties don't really reach out to the unaffiliated voters as a party. Instead, they let the candidates try to sort it out. Well, abortion wasn't a candidate. Abortion couldn't speak for itself. And so we worked really hard to try to give it a voice. We really focused on rural organizing, even though we all live in a city right now, and we're in Douglas County, which is the highest number of registered Democrats per capita. I'm in a state that voted 88% no as a county against that abortion amendment. So we actually focused on more of the rural areas. And, you know, between COVID and some of the rural-urban divide that happened after the 2016 election, people were actually glad to see us. People were excited to have, you know, out-of-town visitors because that had not been happening much since the pandemic happened. And we started having meetings and we developed projects that were like a kit. We tried to make everything like a kit. So we would hand people postcards that were stacked up with addresses ready to go kind of thing. So all they had to do was hand out stacks of little postcards and ask volunteers to write those, hand write those cards instead of mass mailings that were slick and glossy. We also worked really hard to ensure that we put out a lot of ads and information in Spanish. We were the only organization working on this issue that did that consistently. We have four counties in the state of Kansas that are majority Spanish-speaking counties, and nobody should have to ask for access. So our chapter took that really seriously as well. And then all that texting for Bernie that our members had done over the years, we... had the skills to text the entire state. We absolutely use different messaging for unaffiliated Democratic, Libertarian, and registered Republicans. But we had a great time doing it and talking to everybody across the state. I'm not sure if we were just ready for this or if we were so tired of COVID, we were ready to talk about abortion, I guess. I will throw out real quick that the problem is we have to do it again. The Republicans did have a backup plan. Should they lose in August, they have an additional amendment in November that would change the way that we deal with veto power and veto overrides in the state of Kansas. They're also concerned about losing supermajority in the House, and so that's why they have another amendment that could lead them to ban abortion in our next session. As much as we would love to just relax and celebrate that big August 2nd win, we actually have to do this again in like 76 days.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I mean, nobody can be complacent about any of these struggles that we're in right now, least of all abortion rights. That's a message that we try to put out pretty consistently here in New York City, New York State. We're constantly saying, you know, please don't sleep on this. This isn't something that we can just assume is going to be a right. We really need to actively struggle. And I'd love to hear from Alyssa on that in just a minute. But Russell, do you have anything to add to Melinda's comments about this campaign?
I really appreciated hearing Melinda's comments. The strategy that they followed and that other organizations like the Lawrence DSA followed were really quite brilliant. One of the things that longtime observers here in Kansas are aware of is that, as Melinda pointed out, Kansas is actually less a very conservative state and more a rather Republican state. She mentioned that unaffiliated voters were the second largest group of voters within Kansas. The largest is Republicans. The smallest is Democrats. And on one level, you might look at that and say, well, you've got a whole bunch of people that are just going to follow the Republican Party line. And sometimes that's true, and that makes it difficult to push forward different ideas. But what it also means is that within these Republican voters, you have people that might be there for kind of libertarian reasons. You might have people that are there for a variety of different reasons. You've got your hardcore Christian conservatives, but then you also have a lot of rural, just leave us alone type conservatives. And there are ways, and obviously a lot of good organizers found ways to communicate with a lot of these low propensity Republicans and unaffiliated voters, people who maybe come from Republican families, but they don't vote very often. They're not terribly involved in politics. And they were able to present in front of these people, well, have you seen what's happened in Oklahoma? Have you seen what's happened in Missouri? Are you really comfortable with taking away this one protection that the state Supreme Court has provided and making it possible for the legislature to enact a total abortion ban? And the fact of the matter is that you had a lot of, Republicans and unaffiliated and libertarian types show up along with the Democrats and the progressives to vote no. And so it's real genius to reach out to many different types that way.
I tell you what, Russell, there were times where, you know, I'd go to these small towns of 9,000, 12,000, 15,000, and I'd see 300 to 400 or 500 people marching in the street together, or a couple hundred people get together out in the, you know, don't forget Kansas heat. We're out there talking in a microphone in 104 degree sun. But it was, you know, that important people to come out. And I was watching this happen and think, man, when you got libertarians and socialists marching with the Democrats in the street, I think the Republicans overplayed their hand here. And I think that's what happened.
You're tuned in to Revolutions Per Minute here on WBAI. We are the officially endorsed show of New York City DSA. And tonight we're very pleased to be visited by some comrades from Kansas speaking on a recent anti-abortion ballot measure that they organized against and successfully defeated at the ballot box. We also have a local organizer here in New York City from the Reproductive Justice Collective, and we'd love to hear your voice on the show tonight as well. Please give us a call at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. The topic tonight is abortion rights and how we can organize to keep them for all people across the United States. So, Alyssa, you know, from your perspective as somebody who's organizing here in New York City, what response do you have to what happened in Kansas and what you just heard from Russell and Melinda?
Yeah, I echo your sentiment earlier that we just can never be complacent. I think that's something that as activists in New York, we're constantly saying. And, you know, just to circle back to how this all ties into the Federalist Society as well, here in New York, we have 14 Federalist Society judges in the Southern District of New York, and at least 10 recognized members of the Federalist Society on the Second Circuit bench. So the presence is incredibly strong in the judiciary, even in New York City. And I think for that reason alone, amongst many others, we have to stay very vigilant. And we see this activism, particularly in the Federalist Society picket that happened earlier this summer. It was quite the poignant moment. I was talking to a fellow organizer about how it really painted a picture of class struggle. You see these white wealthy men walking into their private university social club in Manhattan, and there are, you know, a band of cops who are protecting them, who are mostly people of color, and then protesters out on the street who are mostly women, gender nonconforming, and people of color as well. And it really was a gruesome but accurate depiction of where we are in the classism in America right now. So I think that learning from those strategies, like you said, Melinda, and just staying vigilant, always finding the next fight and being prepared is the best measure, regardless of whether you're in a hostile state or a destination state like New York.
Absolutely, Alyssa. And as somebody who was also there at that picket, which was outside of a book signing event from Bill Barr, and we tried to do our best to keep the target of the protest under wraps until we were there, so they weren't necessarily expecting to have protesters outside. And that was also such a huge element of it, right? This very clear shock that was coming off of these people that, wow, we are being yelled at when we're trying to go to this book signing event. And it's like, yep, people are getting yelled at when they're trying to go to get an abortion. So, and that's part of the project that you've maintained and you've protected. So how does it feel, right? And I think it's also part of this idea of bringing the fight to them, naming the actors who are behind all of this and not pretending that this is some natural organic force, but really explicating the fact that there are lots of organized groups and there's lots of money, as Chris said earlier in the show, that's going to push this agenda. So if you have any thoughts on this issue, please give us a call. Our phones are open now for the remainder of the show. The line here in the studio is 212-209-2877. That is 212-209-2877. And Melinda, tell me a little bit about the language and rhetoric that was successful for you in Kansas around talking to voters about this issue.
Yeah, and I think it was most evident in our conversations with the unaffiliated voter populations, where there are a lot of people that are to the left of the Democratic Party that are, you know, frustrated with the Biden administration, frustrated with the DNC and their choices that they've made over the last 6 to 8 years, that are kind of hiding in that unaffiliated voter group. And I think that everybody in Kansas is tired of partisan language and polarizing language. We had the most success just being as plain language as possible, like just asking people, so you're going to vote yes or no on that amendment on August 2nd. We didn't ask people for money initially, that kind of thing. You know, a lot of political messaging is a message, a picture of Nancy Pelosi or James Carville or something, and then they'll tell you to, we care what you think, you know, and then give us money. We were genuinely just trying to form relationships with people and have conversations about abortion. We also spent a lot of time addressing misinformation and outright lies that were coming from the Value Them Both supporters. They sent out text messages that I hope continue to be investigated by the Government Ethics Commission a few days before the election. One of our most successful parts about our frequently asked questions, our FAQ on our website at votenokansas.org, votenokansas, all spelled out, .org. Our FAQ was focused on their talking points. So take your opposition's talking points and honestly answer the questions one at a time when you're talking to people. And I think that was really, really effective because when you tell people, oh, they want to use your tax dollars to pay for all these abortions, there's a lot of people that don't like that idea. Well, actually, that's against the law, both the federal and the state level. And so we would share the state Kansas statutes that would make that be against the law to make it clear that they were being lied to by the Value Them Both folks.
Okay, and it seems like we have a caller, so let's have them on the line, see what they have to say.
Yes, good evening. This is Mayat calling from the Grotto. Thank you for this program. However, I think one thing in particular is missing I'd like to hear some discussion about, and that is as white supremacy becomes trending in mainstream, book banning, banning authors, et cetera, et cetera. And related, of course, to women's book, but we're not seeing how this lack of autonomy of a woman's body. I mean, the woman is a true god and as goddess because life comes through her. So somehow we can just rush past that. Also, I think the strategies, particularly of the Democrats and everyone else for that matter. When did we get to the point where we do a rundown of where Christianity comes from? And I'm talking about going back to it is a solar religion and then coming out of Africa. You know, these evangelicals, whatever they are so off target and they need to have an important history lesson. And I'll look for your response over there. And they impossible to get through. I hope Max is okay because he's usually on the case. Okay, thanks, Max.
Okay, thank you for your interesting call. Does anyone here have a response to that? I'll throw it to you, Russell.
Oh, I would just want to say that, you know, her concerns about the rise of white supremacy and, you know, these struggles we have in trying to make Christian beliefs or that some people have trying to make Christian beliefs normative and, you know, impose them, you know, as part of a broader ideology. Obviously, that's a huge part of what's going on in the Republican Party today. We saw and still see, Melinda and I would see a good deal of that in Kansas in different ways. And I think Melinda's point in talking about how she reached out to voters and how other organizers reached out to voters in trying to avoid, you know, the, you know, flashing a picture of Nancy Pelosi, where a lot of people have been taught by Fox News to say, oh, well, you know, she's a servant of Satan, so I know that that's evil and I know how to vote there. You get past that. You get past these big picture issues and you try to speak plainly about people's interests, about what the law actually says and what it actually allows. Real organizing, it seems obvious to me, is organizing that gets away from the big party issues, from trying to make everything into a religious war or, you know, trying to make it into, you know, some kind of conflict that people feel like they've already been plugged into in some ideological way. You want to find more local ways to address things. And I think the success of the movement here in Kansas reveals that very much.
I would just like to remind everybody that 100 years ago, the Christian socialist movement was a huge thing. Most of the preachers, especially in the Midwest and in Southeast Kansas, that ran the biggest circulation socialist newspaper in the world. You know, that is still here and alive. And we do have a Senate candidate that is a preacher that supported the Vote No movement, Mark Holland. And we had so many nuns come to our little postcard parties and bring it with their perfect nun handwriting and to write thousands of postcards to encourage people to vote no, much to the chagrin of the patriarchy inside of the Catholic Church here in Kansas. And we worked with the ICC, Indian Community Center, and also Wichita Birth Justice Society, because those groups specifically address how abortion bans are colonization on indigenous bodies and reproduction, and also the harm caused day in, day out by obstetric violence. And this is just one more attack on Black bodies and Black lives. And supporting those organizations and working with them was really important too, because we know who is going to jail the most or going to die the most, because as far as maternal deaths go in the state of Kansas, 2/3 of maternal deaths are Black, Indigenous, or Spanish-speaking community members, and they account for 20% of the population. So huge atrocity. Disparity is not a big enough word. Hey, next Monday night, DSA's National Electoral Committee, there's 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern meeting. We are going to go over the steps that we took as Vote No Kansas and Lawrence DSA, and we hope that it's applicable to those of you that are fighting a ballot initiative this November and or fighting against politicians from that Christo fascist movement. We want to be open and help anybody that is in this fight with us across the nation.
Thank you, Melinda. And we are coming to the end of our show, but just want to give our third guest a chance for any closing comments or responses before we say goodbye for the night. Alyssa, anything to add?
I would just add that, particularly talking about the fight in New York, for us student organizers, the next frontier is bringing medication abortion onto college campuses. And we are currently working with the New York State Legislature as well as the City Council to pass bills requiring it at public universities. We also have an ongoing campaign to require Columbia and its affiliates. So if you are a public health student or you are simply interested in increasing access for students on college campuses, thereby freeing up space at community clinics for out-of-state people coming into New York, you can find us at Repro Justice Collective on Instagram, and we will be sharing all the information about our upcoming events and actions that you can get involved with.
Thank you for that. And thank you for Russell and Melinda for joining us here tonight. I think it's been a wonderful program, and I think, speaking from Amy and I think it ended up being like far greater than what we could have imagined. So thank you all for coming on. So you're listening to Revolutions for a Minute on listener sponsor WBAI and NYC Broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can also find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. I'm Chris Carr.
I'm Amy Wilson.
And thanks for listening, and forever in the struggle. Solidarity across the nations of the world. Have a good night.
Abortion is freedom. See you next week.